Hi again, everyone. This is Mark Movsesian. I'm the director of the Center for Law and Religion at St. John's Law School. I'm joined once again by my friend and colleague, Mark DiGirolami, who is the center's associate director, for another episode of Legal Spirits, which is our podcast series on cases and issues in law and religion. You can find past episodes by going to Apple iTunes or also by going to our blog, lawandreligionforum.org. That's one word, lawandreligionforum.org. Okay, well, today, Mark, we're going to talk about a new law and religion case that the Supreme Court has agreed to hear this term. It's a case called Espinoza. It comes out of Montana, and it concerns an issue of state funding of religious institution. The court granted cert. It hasn't yet set a time for argument. And I should say to our listeners, this is going to be the first of a few podcasts on this case. We'll do one now. We'll do one later after oral argument. And then we'll do another when the case is ultimately decided, because this has the potential for being a very significant case with regard to state funding of religious institutions. Mark, you want to give us some background on the issues involved?
Sure. So I think to understand the case, it's probably important to have just a little bit of historical background, because some of the history, American law and religion history, is an important feature in the kind of background of this case. So, and that history really concerns something called the Blaine Amendment and subsequent Blaine Amendments passed, ratified within individual state constitutions.
Okay, Mark, so why are they called Blaine Amendments? Who was Blaine?
Okay, well, so in the 1870s and the 1880s, a group of, that really was a kind of composite of secularist reformers, proto-liberals, as well as nativists and anti-Catholic elements, organized a national campaign to pass a constitutional amendment enshrining separation of church and state. And the movement, which, as I say, had both anti-Christian and more specifically anti-Catholic components, had as its leader, as its champion, the Republican Senator James G. Blaine of the state of Maine, who happened to have been the Republican candidate for the presidency in the 1884 election and lost to Grover Cleveland.
Right, James G. Blaine, continental liar from the state of Maine, I think is what they called him.
Yes, that's right.
And he lost to Grover Cleveland, and one reason he lost was largely because of an incident that took place here in New York in which he shared a platform with a Protestant minister who made a remark about how the Democrats were the party of rum, Romanism, and rebellion.
Okay, so this is very interesting, and it definitely shows the specifically anti-Catholic component of this composite movement.
Yeah, well, I mean, Blaine was embarrassed by that particular comment, but he was associated very much with Protestants. And, you know, Mark, it's interesting what you say. You say that the Blaine Amendments were the result of a campaign by secularist reformists. And I never thought of it that way. I always thought the Blaine Amendment was all about, or the Blaine Amendments were all about Protestants specifically fighting against Catholics. But you think you say it's something different.
Well, as I say, not necessarily different. There's certainly a powerful political component of anti-Catholicism, and that's the more deeply rooted component. As early as the 1840s and 1850s, there were worries about anti-Catholicism and the direction of the public schools, making sure that they were under Protestant control and so on. But at least some historians, and Philip Hamburger is certainly one, say that by the time of the 1880s and 1890s, there were various leagues of enlightened voters and political movements which themselves called themselves secularist and liberal, and which were more generally anti-Christian, specifically anti-traditional Christianity or hierarchical Christianity, that were responsible for some of the action with respect to the Blaine Amendment.
That's very interesting, and they somehow got a Republican presidential candidate to endorse this. Okay, so Mark, what did the Blaine Amendments actually say? They had to do with money specifically,
okay,
right?
Okay, well, so the Blaine's own amendment would have rewritten the First Amendment to apply it to the states, and to include this language, quote, "No money raised by taxation in any state for the support of public schools shall ever be under the control of any religious sect, nor shall any money so raised be divided between religious sects of denominations," close quote. So it was a provision specifically targeting money and the distribution of money from the public fisc. The National Amendment ended up failing.
Yeah, obviously failed. That's not part of the Constitution.
It failed, but it came very close to being passed. It failed by two votes in Congress, it did represent a significantly more restrictive approach to church-state relations, and one that specifically targeted sectarian schools, which at the time was a kind of code word or signal for Catholicism. But as I say, there were a number of different coalitions that came together to make this amendment almost a success.
Okay, so it failed at the national level, but it had some success at the state level.
That's right. So on the strength at the state level, on the strength primarily of anti-Catholic feeling, many states in the late 1880s enacted similar language to the language that failed on the national level as part of their own state constitutions. And one of those states was Montana, which introduced equivalent language into its state constitution in Article 10, Section 6 of its state constitution.
Okay, and of course, there's a Montana law that is at issue in this case. So let's talk about the precise Montana provision.
Okay, so that's the background. Mm-hmm. And the specific Montana law here is a 2015 Montana law passed providing for tax credits for taxpayers who donate to educational programs in Montana.
Right. And we should note, by the way, that the way this worked was, and I have to say, Mark, I had to read through it a couple of times to figure it out. And I think that's probably because the Montana legislators were trying very carefully to make this constitutional and set it up this way.
You may be right about that. It is actually somewhat unclear, even from the description in the lower court opinion, as well as the petition for cert, exactly what goes on. But what's your understanding?
So my understanding is that Montana will give a dollar-for-dollar tax credit up to $150, so a fairly modest amount, to a taxpayer who donates to a so-called Student Scholarship Organization, SSO. And these SSOs then can provide parents and students with scholarships to attend private schools. And among those private schools are religiously based schools. I think it's important for our listeners to note, this is the part it took me a couple of times to figure out, that the taxpayer cannot use the credit to pay for his own kids' schooling anywhere. So there's not a one-to-one correspondence that way.
Or it just goes into a fund.
Goes into a fund, yeah. And the fund will then distribute it among different schools.
So I think you're right, Mark, both as a matter of the amount of money involved, which is very, very small, actually, $150, and as a matter of this sort of somewhat Byzantine structure that they put into place, it seems like the Montana legislature was trying to insulate this law from state constitutional attack at the very least.
Right, but it didn't work because the Montana Department of Revenue, which had administrative responsibility for implementing this statute, concluded that the program was unconstitutional under that provision of the Montana Constitution you just mentioned.
That's right. So it adopted a rule, which it called Rule 1, and in that rule, it excludes religious schools from the program, obviously including Catholic schools. Catholic schools make up the vast majority of the private schools in Montana for which these dollars would have paid tuition. And so the Department of Revenue adopted this rule.
Right. Although somewhat ironically, given the anti-Catholic history of the Blaine Amendments, in this particular lawsuit, you have parents of children who went to a non-denominational Protestant school suing because their school was not allowed to get money from the state fund, and therefore they were excluded from this, and they argued this was a violation of their religious freedom.
Right, because of course the department couldn't have excluded specifically Catholic schools.
Right. Or Protestant schools.
Notwithstanding that that may have been the very purpose of the Blaine Amendment in the first place, it certainly wasn't to exclude Protestant schools.
No, but this is what happens over time. Once these things get put into law, then the meaning sort of evolves, or the social meaning evolves anyway. Okay, so these parents sue because the school to which they send their children is not entitled to participate in this scholarship fund. That's the factual background. So what did the lower court in Montana say?
Okay, so the trial court upheld the statute, but the Montana Supreme Court did not.
Yeah, what did the Supreme Court say?
So the Montana Supreme Court said that Montana's constitutional ban on aid to sectarian schools narrows what the Supreme Court once called the quote-unquote play in the joints between what the Free Exercise Clause requires and the Establishment Clause prohibits.
Yeah, and if I could just tell our listeners, I mean, Mark and I were talking about this before. I find this metaphor singularly unhelpful. I think it just obscures a lot of things. I don't know why they would pick some sort of anatomical or, you know, machine-like, machine metaphor for this. I just think play in the joints adds nothing to the analysis, and I want to make this plea right now to the justices just to ditch that metaphor.
So I have a somewhat more favorable view of the metaphor. You can think about two bones and the joint between them, and the joint has a certain amount of synovial fluid that might be coursing through it, and it's within that synovial fluid that the states can play, where they can have room to move in ways that they wouldn't if the joints were attached one to another. But everybody has their own taste with respect to metaphors.
I'm anticipating a future article on synovial jurisprudence of the religion clauses. Okay, so anyway, let's explain a little more for the listeners what exactly the Montana court said.
All right, so in specific, it says, look, Montana's Blaine Amendment, that provision prohibits any state aid to sectarian schools. It draws a more stringent line than what is required by the Constitution, the one that is constitutionally permissible.
Right, and so that's an important thing to state here, which is the states can be stricter about the Establishment Clause than the federal government can. That's certainly allowed.
And in fact, in the decision, the Montana court spends almost no time on federal constitutional law. It sort of quickly says Montana's Blaine Amendment is not problematic under the United States Constitution, and there's very, very little discussion.
Well, they just have a sentence saying we're just not going to discuss federal precedent, which I have to say, just as a matter of judicial opinion writing, struck me as shocking.
Yeah, I was surprised by that as well. Now, there are some concurrences that do make the point about, so Montana has a 7-justice Supreme Court. 5 justices joined in the majority opinion, but there were some concurring opinions that do discuss a little bit of federal constitutional law, but the majority opinion spent most of its time discerning the scope of Montana's Blaine Amendment and holding that it prohibits direct or indirect aid of any kind to sectarian schools. It said, look, this provision, which has been adapted from the 1889 version of the Montana Constitution, was, quote, among the most stringent no-aid clauses in the nation, close quote. It was passed to keep education, quote, free from religious entanglement, close quote. It prohibits any type of aid, and the court emphasized this issue of any type whatsoever, unlike other state constitutions that prohibit more specific kinds of subsidies taken from the public treasury.
Okay, so that, and I have to say, I mean, I'm not an expert in Montana law, but reading the Montana opinion, it struck me as perfectly plausible that that is the right reading of the Montana Blaine Amendment.
I agree with that. It seems that as a matter of the interpretation of the amendment, the language does seem broad. Under that reading, it's clear that the Montana tax subsidy, said the court, violates the Montana Blaine Amendment. It allows the legislature indirectly to pay tuition at private religiously affiliated schools. And so the court says the donation to the middleman, to the student scholarship organization, irrelevant.
Right.
The amount of money, this small $150 per student, irrelevant. Mm-hmm. Because of the breadth and the hard edges of Montana's Blaine Amendment.
Right. Now, we should say, of course, the Montana court could be 100% correct on Montana law, but still be wrong about the federal free exercise clause. And this case is ultimately, in the U.S. Supreme Court, is ultimately a free exercise clause challenge.
I think that's true. And there's, as we said, there's very, very little discussion in the Montana Supreme Court decision about this. The Montana Supreme Court said no violation of the free exercise clause, but it didn't explain why there wasn't. It just said, quote, this is not one of those cases, close quote, implicating the free exercise clause. Didn't even discuss Trinity Lutheran, which we'll get to in a moment, just stated its conclusion together with this, quote, the basic notion of separation of church and state is a foundation of our nation's federal constitution, but it is more fiercely protected by Montanans, close quote. So this is, that says as much as one needs to know, it seems to me, about the perspective from which the Montana Supreme Court was coming. It's a very strong separationist decision. Boom, case closed.
Okay, so now let's talk about the U.S. Supreme Court case. So the court granted cert in this case to consider what, Mark? What's the question for the U.S. Supreme Court in this case?
Well, so there are two basic arguments that were made in the cert petition. First, the argument was that there is a split about whether the government can bar religious options from otherwise neutral and generally applicable, neutrally available student aid programs. Right. So the petition says, yes, the Supreme Court in a case called Locke versus Davy, a case where the state of Washington had excluded from a scholarship program a course of study in devotional theology. There's the same play in the joints metaphor language
there. I think that's where it comes from, right?
It might come from there. But that case, the petition says, involves the religious training of the clergy, which is different than what's at stake here.
Well, I would think that the mere fact that the metaphor about the play in the joints comes from Locke makes Locke worthy of being overruled just there.
I mean, so we'll see. I've never seen a case overruled on the basis
bad
of rejecting
metaphor.
The metaphor, right. although we've got perhaps a differently disposed
but
Supreme
actually,
Court now.
But I mean, I wonder, we're just joking around here, but I don't think Locke is really what this case is about, because Locke was about a kid who wanted to use state money specifically to study to be a minister, devotional theology.
That's right.
And the court in Locke several times said that that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about using your money at religious schools more generally.
Yeah, I think that's true. And in fact, the program in Washington allowed students to attend religious schools, provided they didn't use the funds to pursue a devotional theological degree.
And there's no indication, I mean, this I believe is an elementary school. There's no indication that the kids are learning how to be priests or ministers, I should say.
That's absolutely right. So the other key Supreme Court case, which is perhaps closer to what's going on here, is, as we said, Trinity Lutheran versus Comer, which was decided in 2017, which was decided as a free exercise case, and where the court addressed religious exclusions in an institutional aid program involving playground resurfacing.
Right. And that, Mark, seems to me the more important case here, Trinity Lutheran. So the facts of that case were what, Mark?
Well, the facts of that case concerned a neutral program that the legislature had enacted for, as I say, resurfacing of playgrounds. And I believe it's a Missouri case.
Missouri.
And Missouri also has a so-called Blaine Amendment. It's a little bit different. The structure of the amendment is different. Doesn't mention sectarian schools in particular. But what ended up happening there was that the Missouri excluded, again, religious schools from these general subsidies that were being awarded. And the Supreme Court eventually said, no, you can't do that on the basis of the religious identity or status of
Correct.
The school.
There's a lot of talk in Trinity Lutheran about the state not being able to exclude religious groups, religious organizations from state aid programs on the basis of status. That is, you are a church, you can't get it.
That's right.
Which sort of looks like that's what's happening here in this case.
It's true. Now, and this is pointed out in the cert petition, four justices in the 7-justice majority joined this footnote in Trinity Lutheran, which limited the case to the specific facts in front of it. Right?
It's a case about playgrounds.
It's about playground resurfacing.
Right.
Right. So
right.
I don't see how you could be any narrower than that. But the petition says, look, the court hasn't yet addressed exclusions from student aid or tuition reimbursement programs more broadly, and you've got different circuits and state courts going in different directions. You've got the 6th and the 8th Circuit on one side of the question saying that states cannot exclude religious institutions from these sorts of tuition subsidy programs. And then you've got the 1st and the 9th Circuit, as well as the High Court of Maine and a couple of others on the other side, saying that it's permissible to do this. So that's one issue. Mm-hmm. The second issue for accepting cert raised by the petition is that this split and this uncertainty is deeply problematic for students and their parents, and particularly low-income students who are helped by these tuition aid programs. Mm-hmm. So that's a more practical question
right.
presented. But behind all of this, Mark, and maybe we could talk a little bit about this, is the more general question about what neutrality and equality really mean. You know, just what the difference is, for example, between neutrality in the administration of these programs and hostility to religion, which is a theme that we sort of see recurring in a number of the issues that we talk about.
Well, and most recently in the most recent Supreme Court opinion on the Free Exercise Clause, which is Masterpiece Cake Shop, in which the court said that the case, there was a violation of religious freedom because the administrative agency in that case expressed hostility toward the religious believers' religious beliefs. That was the animus that you're talking about.
Right. I think in the background there's another issue here, which is whether the kind of animus or discriminatory motivation questions that have permeated some of the court's recent religious liberty cases, like Masterpiece Cake Shop, are going to recur here, whether the court is going to use that kind of analysis in looking to see whether what the motivations for Montana's Blaine Amendment are, whether it will inquire into that history. Animus has certainly, as you say, it's certainly figured very prominently into some of these other cases. One option for the court, although not an option that was specifically requested in the questions presented, is to start exploring the history of anti-Catholic bias that motivated some of these amendments. It's not necessary, I don't think, for the court to get into those questions. It could just look to see what the rule does in this case. But it's certainly an option. It's one that, for example, Justice Thomas has hinted at before when he doesn't like, in fact, I think the separationist talk in the Montana Supreme Court majority opinion is going to raise the hackles of at least some of the justices.
I mean, just talking off the top of my head here, I wonder if there isn't a statute of limitations kind of issue here. I mean, so if you think about Animus and Masterpiece Cake Shop, that was the actual administrative body, the adjudicative administrative body that was the commission that was deciding the case. You know, and if you think back to a case like Lukumi, it was the actual town that had passed the ordinance under review, which had maybe acted with bias against the Santeria faith. But here we're talking about, I mean, the Montana Constitution, I think it's 1972. That's the most recent
version. That's the most recent, but the initial one is, you know, 19th century.
Right. And I'm not saying they couldn't do this, but I wonder if they will really engage, if their commitment to animus would go so far as to have them engage in a sort of a kind of history of the 19th century animus. Because you might say whatever the animus existed then, that's a long time ago. That's not what's motivating decisions today.
You know, this...
I'm not saying that's right, listeners. I'm just raising this off the top of my head.
This point is very interesting, Mark. It actually suggests an analogy with American Legion and the Establishment Clause cases that we've been looking at with respect to state-sponsored religious displays, where the court basically now has a jurisprudence of old monuments, that if it's really old, it's too difficult to find out what the motivations are or what the purposes are, because it's acquired many purposes and those purposes have sort of been whitewashed and neutralized over time. And maybe there's a kind of an equivalent free exercise, an analog that it will use here, that when you've got a motivation that's so difficult to disentangle from right motivation, wrong motivation, in the sands of time, we're just going to leave that alone and just look at the operation of the law. I have to say, Mark, my own preference would be for the court to avoid that kind of motivational analysis, even as I think that if it actually engaged in it, it could find some very unpleasant things. But to just simply look at the operation of the law, that would be a perfectly clean way to get at this kind of case.
Yeah, I suspect that they're not going to reach out to do a large-scale legal history project here, but we'll see. Okay, so you can see, listeners, why we think this is an important case. We'll come back and talk about it more after oral argument, and of course we'll have other broadcasts, we hope, before then. So for now, this is Mark Movsesi and Mark DiGirolami from the Center for Law and Religion with another episode of Legal Spirits. You can find past episodes on Apple iTunes and also on our website, lawandreligionforum.org. That's one word, lawandreligionforum.org.